Hello and welcome to AstroTalk UK. AT UK is a not-for-profit 30-minute weekly audio podcast primarily for and by amateur astronomers in the UK. Available only online, AT UK is a virtual meeting point for the amateur astronomy community. Each episode is an MP3 file which can be downloaded automatically with a free subscription via one of the many podcast readers. I use iTunes. My name is Gurbir Singh and I host AT UK. I am not a scientist nor am I an astronomer. Topics of discussion have no fixed boundaries other than their relevance to amateur astronomy. Each week's episode consists of pre-recorded conversations with individuals discussing the roles, lives and achievements of amateur astronomers and their hobby. More about AT UK at www.astrotalkuk.org. If you have a topic for discussion, drop me a note on info@astrotalkuk.org. AstroTalk UK, amateur astronomy, expert opinion. Episode 15, Sunday, May the 11th, 2008. Life on Earth and how it could have started. Astrobiology is the study of life outside the Earth. Paradoxically, it is advanced by understanding how life started here on Earth. 10 years ago, any scientist researching anything that could have been regarded as astrobiology, exoplanets, chemical evolution, or indeed search for extraterrestrial life, intelligent or otherwise, would have kept it quiet. Today, these exciting areas of research are flourishing. In the famous Miller-Urey experiment to discover the origins of life, they did not create primitive life, but succeeded in creating organic molecules from inorganic constituents. The starting point for the Miller-Urey experiment was the chemical composition of the early Earth's atmosphere. Could meteorites also have given life a helping hand? In today's episode, Dr. Terry Key from the School of Chemistry, University of Leeds, talks about the key processes involving phosphorus that may have been critical in kick-starting life on Earth. The type of phosphorus required for these processes is not found on the surface of the Earth today, but it is found in iron meteorites. Dr. Key explains the connection between phosphorus and living organisms.
Phosphorus is one of the central elements in life as we understand it. We think of life as being organic, built of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, with a sprinkling of other elements like nitrogen and sulfur. And phosphorus is one of those. It's a key element in the way that life has developed on Earth. For example, some of the key molecules of life, DNA, RNA, are built of phosphorus. They contain phosphorus atoms in them, in the form of a chemical unit called phosphate. Phosphate, most of us, even if we haven't come across the name, we'll be familiar with its effects and use in our daily lives. We brush our teeth with toothpaste that is chock full of phosphate. We drink tins of fizzy drink, Pepsi, for example, is full of phosphoric acid. And that's a type of phosphate. So the unit, if you like, or the chemical entity in which phosphorus is used in life, phosphate, is all around us.
Yeah, I certainly am aware of it from the fertilizer. It's a key ingredient for life.
Yeah.
So why is phosphorus important in the early developments? And I'm thinking now way back to beginning of life here on Earth, about 3.8 billion years ago.
Yeah, again, that's a very good question. And this is really what got us interested in studying phosphorus in the whole context of the origin of life. I guess the story goes back to the 1950s when an American scientist called Addison Gulick published a paper in a journal called The American Scientist. And he flagged up that there was a bit of a problem with nature having used phosphorus in the form of phosphate, fertilizer material, in en route to life on the early Earth. Now, he highlighted this problem, and it came in two parts. The problem is that life today, let me just go back, life today is extremely intricate and complex in a chemical sense. And in order to do that, nature has had to develop a whole range of molecular systems, enzymes, cells, all sorts of systems, in order to do the chemical functions of life. En route to life at the beginning, 3.8 billion years ago, it's quite likely that that chemistry then would have not been available to nature. And probably it would have had to make use of far simpler chemistries on the early Earth. And this was the tone of Gulick's thesis. Mm-hmm. He noted two important characteristics about phosphate, the same material that we have in our Coke drink, things that we have in our toothpaste and fertilizer. Mm-hmm. Number one is that as its simple metal salts, it's extremely insoluble in water. So it's very difficult to do chemistry with in water. And even if you do get it, well, when you get it in water at low concentrations, the second, perhaps more important problem is that it is chemically very unreactive. So nature has had to put energy in, if you like, and beat on the system in order to get it to do anything.
Yeah.
And this was a problem. And what Gulick was suggesting is that, well, perhaps now, in terrestrial biochemistry as we understand it, nature has developed very sophisticated mechanisms to extract phosphate from our environment and to activate it chemically.
Right.
Maybe nature used different forms of phosphorus in the early Earth to kickstart some of these processes. Perhaps there were phosphorus chemicals available on the early Earth to nature that are not available today that would have helped facilitate, if you like, the first forms of reproducing system.
So the tradition has it that life started in some primordial soups that's water-based, and as you're saying, phosphates aren't soluble, so there probably wouldn't have been much there, and it's inert, so there wouldn't have been much opportunity for chemical reactions. Yeah. So as an alternative to phosphates, what would have been around in the way of phosphor in that early primordial soup?
Well, this is, again, where one goes back to Gulick, because not only did he pinpoint the problems with phosphate as we use today, he also proposed a couple of possible solutions that nature might have used pre 3.8 billion years ago. And he proposed two chemicals that are very similar, very closely related to phosphate, but they are subtly different chemically. One of them is a material called phosphite, and another one is a material called hyperphosphite. Now, these chemicals have subtle differences, but the bottom line is that these chemicals are both more water-soluble than phosphate and much more chemically reactive.
Is there any evidence that these earlier forms of phosphorus existed on the early Earth?
Yes, this is where myself and my colleague Matt Pasek from the NASA Astrobiology Institute in Arizona, we've worked together for several years now and are continuing. Together, we've shown that, yes, these chemicals, precisely those chemicals proposed by Gulick, can result from the interaction of water and sunlight with certain types of meteoritic material. So this is where the meteorites come in. Meteorites exist in a whole variety of different types, and forgive me, I'm not a meteoriticist or a meteorite specialist, but the type that we're interested in are iron meteorites. Now, iron meteorites contain certain minerals in them which are based on phosphorus. They're actually a mixture of phosphorus, iron and nickel. And what my colleague Matt and I have shown, that under slightly different conditions, we can take these minerals inside a meteorite, treat them with water, shine light on them, and we produce a range of phosphorus chemicals, including the ones that Gulick proposed to be useful on the early Earth, phosphite and hyperphosphite.
The picture that you seem to be painting is that the phosphate we have today available in abundance on the Earth probably was a non-starter, literally, in that primordial soup, but phosphite and hyperphosphite, which was around then, delivered to the Earth from meteorites, is what kick-started life.
It would certainly be far better if one imagines that nature is presented with this primordial soup, a mass of chemicals with which to do chemistry, to develop the first forms of self-replicating living systems, whatever they may have been. I suspect that nature would probably have looked at the options available and would have worked first with the things that it found easiest to do. And the problems with phosphate is that it is not the easiest thing to do chemistry with. And I suspect nature will have probably tried to start to do chemistry with the easier chemicals, the more reactive ones, the more the ones in which there was a greater local source of them. And certainly phosphite and hyperphosphite would be far better suited to that type of world than phosphate.
Well, that sounds extremely plausible on the basis that pretty much all the water we have on the planet now came to the Earth from comets. So you've got a grant recently for half a million pounds. How do you? What sort of questions are you hoping to answer with that?
Well, there's a number of questions we want to answer. They come in two big parts, really. Number one is, how is it? Let's look in a little bit more detail at how phosphorus-containing meteorites could undergo chemical transformation within early Earth environments to see how that influences both the rate at which phosphorus is released into an early Earth environment and also exactly what sort of concentrations could have been around. So we want to look in more detail at the corrosion chemistry of iron meteorites, and that involves looking at a range of experimental techniques, a range of spectroscopies, a range of electrochemical techniques that we do in collaboration with very good colleagues at Bradford University and Sheffield Hallam University. So they're on board on that side. And then the second side of it is really to take some of the phosphorus chemicals that come from these meteorites and let's just look at it from nature's viewpoint. Let's suppose that some of these exotic chemicals like phosphite and hyperphosphite being available to nature on the early Earth, what could nature have done with them? Can we explore, as I like to think about, the chemical space? What could nature have done? And what we have shown, even in our preliminary studies to date, is that hyperphosphorus acid, in particular hyperphosphite, is very reactive chemically. And what we can do is we can introduce that into organic molecules that would have been available on the early Earth, and also organic molecules that play a role in biochemistry today. Pyruvic acid, for example, which is a very important chemical that's produced via glucose metabolism. We can show that pyruvic acid, which would have been around on the early Earth, reacts quite cleanly and selectively with hyperphosphite, and it allows one to introduce phosphorus into organic molecules, which is essentially what nature does today, admittedly different chemical mechanisms to how it did then. But what we're trying to do is to see what sort of chemical behavior could nature have used with these very simple phosphorus, yet reactive phosphorus chemicals. And can we possibly develop ways in which nature could have built simple polymers or simple materials which would be able to, which nature could use to transfer information, whether it's genetic information or whether it's chemical information?
So that's really quite fascinating, because the kind of meteorites that are normally associated with organic chemistry are the carbonaceous meteorites, which seem to have jumped a step, if you like, in the development of life. Is it possible that more complex molecules arrived on Earth from meteorites as well as the ideas that you're looking at?
I think scientists certainly believe that, and I think there is evidence to that effect. Certainly the carbonaceous chondrites you mentioned and the Murchison meteorite in particular is one of the leading, the classics. Yes, the classics in this field. And in fact, I think a NASA team identified in 1992 some phosphite in the Murchison meteorite. So the phosphorus chemicals, these unusual highly reactive phosphorus chemicals that one finds, are not solely confined to iron meteorites. But of course, in terms of carbonaceous materials, there are a whole range of compounds that one can find, and quite complicated ones. I'm thinking of carboxylic acids, polycarboxylic acids, whole ranges of polyaromatic hydrocarbons where you have carbon atoms fused together. And there's I think there's now a considerable interest in perhaps looking at whether or not there are alternative models for life on an early Earth. We've heard about the RNA model, and perhaps now there is another one called the aromatic world. One is looking at polyaromatic hydrocarbons, maybe molecules built around these little pieces of graphite, if you like. Mm-hmm. Maybe they could have developed into the first sort of cells, the first reaction containers, so that initial chemistry could have developed. Maybe they could have been catalytic surfaces for other types of reactions. So scientists are definitely looking to build models from molecules that are brought in from space. Yeah.
Going back to the eye meteorites, I take it for your studies, Leeds University will be acquiring some meteorites?
Yes, we have an excellent link with my colleague, Dr. Matt Pasek, at the NASA Astrobiology Institute, as well as being an outstanding geochemist. He also is a collector, an avid collector of gems and meteorites, and he has a fantastic collection, including the Sengchan meteorite, which is one that that I work on quite often. Perhaps I can show it to you. I have a little section.
I'd love to.
This is a pride in our mutual collection.
Wow.
As well.
Yes, that's
quite a heavy chunk.
It is. I mean, it's a small slice, about 5 centimetres long by about 2 or 3 centimetres wide. And, of course, this is just a slice of the original...
There are several kilograms of this particular meteorite on the market now. It's only recently come on the general meteorite market for collectors. This is the Sengchan meteorite. It fell in the Magadan region of Russia, I think, in the 1960s. But it is principally an iron-nickel meteorite. It also has a little bit of siliceous material in there, so I think technically it's called a palisite. But one can see, if one looks at these beautiful markings on the surface, there's Wittmannstatten patterns that one sees in acid-etched iron meteorites.
All right, that's the what looks like lines of bricks, but these are
exactly
rectangles, 3 millimeters by about 15 millimeters, long strips of rectangular bricks laid fairly irregularly. What did you call that?
Wittmannstatten patterns.
Right.
I believe they are intertwined crystals of different minerals of iron nickel. Uh-huh. Two principal types, I think, camasite and taenite are the two principal minerals. And they have slightly different proportions of nickel in them. And this patterning is quite characteristic of meteorites, because they tell us that the parent body from which this came must have cooled down extremely slowly to give rise to those intergrained crystals.
The outside is it's obviously
quite corroded
and rusty, but bits which are sliced off, it's very obviously metallic in colour. Mm. There's no evidence of rust there?
Not a lot. No.
It's a bit of here, I guess.
Yes, there are some dark regions here, and this is the silicate region. There's a mixture of goethite in there, there's some hematite in there, and there's some siliceous material in there. The portions that we're interested in are these very bright inclusions that you can see there.
Yeah.
That is a mineral called schreibersite.
Right. It looks like silver.
Yeah, looks like silver.
Uh-huh.
And that is it's a mixture, it's a mineral of iron, nickel and phosphorus. But phosphorus that's in a form very different to phosphate that we find
everywhere.
And what we find is when we treat those inclusions, water, when we put water on them and shine UV light on them, or in fact introduce some other form of energy, perhaps microwave irradiation, galvanic processes, what we find is that chemical transformations convert the phosphorus in that mineral to a different form of phosphorus, phosphite and hyperphosphite, the species that we're most interested in. So those silvery regions within the meteorite, those are the bits that give off the phosphorus.
Is it fair to say that all the phosphate that we have on the Earth today started off in that form?
Now, that's a very good question. I don't know if that's the case.
Right.
My feeling is that perhaps not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not completely certain of how phosphate in the form of, let's say, calcium phosphate, or whitlockite would have originally found its way into planetary bodies. But what one does know is that schreibersite, that particular mineral, tends to condense more readily in an interstellar environment, within an interstellar nebula, than calcium phosphates and phosphate minerals. But I suspect that these materials, what are called phosphides, would have been formed differently from phosphates. That's my understanding.
Right. The early Earth, which came out of the early solar nebula, that would have had phosphorus in it, and would that necessarily have been the phosphate type?
Well, I suspect it could probably have been both.
Right.
I would envisage that there would be phosphate mineral, and there would also be iron, presumably, in the original solar system accretion disk. And where there is iron, there is almost certainly the likelihood of siderophilic forms, you know, iron-loving forms, like iron carbides, iron nitrides, and this particular one is an iron phosphide. But I guess in a way that once the Earth underwent some form of differentiation, then the iron would become more concentrated in the cores, and the phosphate would have been more concentrated in the mantle and the crust.
Because this type of phosphate finds it easier to be created in the interstellar medium,
yes,
it's more important and relevant to your studies.
It is. It's more important on the early Earth than phosphate, because we're unfortunately not able to actually go back in time to see what the conditions were like in an early Earth environment. But we're pretty sure that there wasn't a great deal of oxygen around. Oxygen in our environment probably started to increase towards the levels we have today when photosynthetic bacteria began. So it's thought that the early Earth was probably a slightly harsher environment than what we have today. Mm-hmm. Probably less oxygen, and therefore probably also devoid of a protective ozone layer that we now have. So there would be greater flux of UV radiation, for example, which is exactly the radiation that one needs to chemically modify these materials. So because the conditions today within our terrestrial atmosphere today are so different to what they were 4+ billion years ago, the chemicals that we get off from these meteorites are quite different to the chemicals that would have been available on the early Earth. Technically, we say that the chemicals we have now in our more oxidizing environment are more oxidized, whereas the sorts of chemicals such as the phosphites, hyperphosphites that I alluded to earlier, they're more stable in a non-oxygen environment.
Yes, and that's another example of the extreme differences in the environment between the early Earth and now.
Yeah.
Although we've now got the ozone layer, we need to be protected from the ultraviolet light. In the early days, ultraviolet light was necessary for triggering life-forming processes.
Absolutely.
The kind of research you're doing seems to indicate, or maybe evidence for, this idea of panspermia. Is that something that is taking on more of a scientifically advocated status these days?
Well, it's an old idea, as I'm sure you're aware, and I think the answer to that question is yes. That is it being more considered seriously as a scientific hypothesis? I think the answer is yes. I think recently I was at a meeting, the Astrobiology Science Conference at the NASA SETI Institute, sponsored last April, and it was very interesting to hear ideas of panspermia or the serious investigations being formed into how microbes, for example, could survive meteorite impacts when they're embedded within solid bodies. So people are now taking panspermia to a sufficiently serious stage that they are designing experiments to show, well, life can exist in such extreme environments. Whether or not we will actually confirm the hypothesis of panspermia is another question. But from my understanding, admittedly, just a limited one at the moment, in principle, there doesn't appear to be any major scientific reason why it isn't possible for life in some way, shape or form to be transmitted from one planetary system to another, let's just say via some meteorite or a cometary fragment, and at some stage then that lands on within another environment and seeds that planet. I can't see a scientific problem with that at the moment.
Sure, and as a scientist, unless you have evidence for it, it's not something you can...
There's no evidence. Yeah. It is very much a hypothesis. Mm. But what one can do from models, of course, one can form experiments which will hopefully show whether or not simple forms of life that we understand on Earth today, bacteria and bacterial spore formation, whether or not bacteria can survive for long periods of time within extreme conditions, low temperatures, high UV flux, impacts, for example.
Search for extraterrestrial intelligence has been going on one form or another for a long time, to date unsuccessfully so. But you're looking at life at the other end, very simple, primitive processes that might have triggered life here on Earth. Given that background that you have, and being aware of the sort of environments that exist on not only terrestrial planets, but perhaps on planets generally throughout the universe, do you think life is something that's relatively easy to get going?
Again, it's a $4,000 question. It's a fantastic question. My own personal belief, and I use the word belief in a quasi-scientific way, I put myself firmly in the Carl Sagan camp. Uh-huh. And I remember being turned on to science by watching his Cosmos series in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And I remember clearly one of the programs he had as part of that series, mm-hmm. where he was envisaging what sort of life might have existed within the upper reaches of the atmospheres of Jupiter. And he had all sorts of weird and wonderful creatures called floaters. Yeah. And
in the atmosphere of Jupiter.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. And for me, as a scientist, I thought it was remarkably bold of him to even think about the possibilities of life elsewhere. But he was doing so from a scientific background. He was taking what they knew as a picture of the environment and templating, if you like, onto it, what sorts of things might have lived there. Now, I like that form of artistic license. As a scientist, I think it is extremely valuable, because what it does is it that element of creativity and creative thinking, and maybe even fanciful thinking, can in many ways direct. It might not give you an answer to the problem, but it might shed light on an experiment to do, or it might shed light on a particular piece of science that you can look for.
It's Einstein who said that imagination is more important than knowledge. Finally, the American spacecraft Phoenix, on its way to Mars, it's got some experiments on board to look for primitive life. I think it's due to land pretty soon, actually. Mm. Perhaps been seduced by the sort of work that you're doing and other people have been doing. In my non-professional, non-scientist way, I get the feeling that we will detect somewhere some form of very primitive life form. It was a huge question 10 years ago, but I just seem to feel it's a bit nearer. Do you get that sense?
I get that sense as well, yes. With the... I think in a way, if one goes back a few years to the Alan Hills episode.
That's 97, this
97,
meteorite from
yes,
Mars.
Yes, 10 years ago now, the meteorite from Mars. Yes, yeah. The Alan Hills meteorite. One looks at the intense global public impact that had, and whereas I think the jury is pretty much now concluded that what was on offer was not an unambiguous piece of evidence of Martian life, I think we are primed for it. Hence we're getting more and more excited about missions to Mars. You mentioned Phoenix, of course ExoMars in a few years time from ESA is going to be a major expedition. Yeah. And I think we are now looking not just at Mars, of course, other sorts of environment, that I believe the solar system will our solar system will give us some clues as to the question of whether life is feasible elsewhere.
Dr. Terence Leaf, the University of Leeds, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you again.
Thank you for listening to AstroTalk UK. ATUK is a non-profit project produced and recorded by Gurbir Singh. He nor any of the participants are paid for their contribution. ATUK's content is not validated against any authoritative source, and all the views and opinions are held by those who choose to express them. If you have a topic of interest you would like to discuss on ATUK, drop me a note, info@astrotalkuk.org.